You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence. And they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may have actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody, welcome. Welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. That's me, Chris Taylor. Thank you so much again. I know I thank you every episode, but here we are on our 31st episode and with some bonus episodes sprinkled in, and still every single episode that I put out, whether it's just on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, now with the video in the last several episodes here in season two, the viewership, the listenership, the downloads, the streams, they continue to go up exponentially every episode. There's new people. And so I can't thank you enough for supporting me, for supporting, this podcast, supporting my process that I go through to think out loud. If this podcast wasn't titled Come This Far, as in we didn't come this far to only come this far, it would probably be called Thinking Out Loud with Chris Taylor, because that's really all this is. And it's really fun. And it's really cool. I get the hang of it more. I'm more comfortable when there's a camera in front of me than when I'm just with the microphone without the camera, because I don't know why. It just seems like I have to be a little bit more on my game, on my toes, because I'm presenting. Like, you know what I mean? It's the visual part of it. So that's helped me, I think. And I'd love your input, but the people that have kind of advised me, friends of mine that listen to the podcast and give me advice and you know, constructive criticisms, they've all said that's the case, that with the video, it seems like you present better, put it that way. And so thank you for being here listening. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about Elon Musk. not just Elon Musk, but really the news surrounding him this past couple weeks. I know with the Capitol insurrection and the failed coup attempt and COVID-19 and, you know, everything that we're dealing with in our personal lives, this news may have slipped through the cracks for some of you. And I'm talking about Elon Musk. When I first heard about Elon Musk, it was probably 2013, 2014. I think SpaceX was just getting announced or up and running. Tesla, his car company, was just kind of getting founded, and there's a lot of excitement around it, but there was a lot of struggle. A lot of experts saying, you know, Elon is a failure. He has grandiose plans and ideas, but he just can't put it together. And I really like Elon. I do. I think he is certainly an inspiration to lots of people, to me. Nearly a year ago, when his company, Tesla, was pretty much written off by experts, he gambled. He gambled nearly his entire fortune to personally guarantee the investment loans. His grant, and the news of this last week proves that his grand risk paid off. You know, he has an unbelievable level of confidence in himself. And I think everybody can gain some sort of inspiration from that. This guy, he's a genius, for one, a bona fide genius. For two, he's just, he's on another level, right? And what I'm talking about is, I think that his net worth several years ago was like $4, $5, $6 billion. I mean, in normal terms, in you and I, that's unheard of. You know, that's you live the rest of your life and several lifetimes of generations, and that's generational wealth, right? But his companies were kind of seen as not very wise investments, or with very high risk, and with the problems that were going on with his companies. A lot of people were very apprehensive and wanted to not have anything to do with investing in his companies, because he's the Tesla, of course, is the electric car company that seems to be at the cutting edge of that technology. SpaceX is the company that he also founded. It's a space exploration company that seems to be, you know, partnering with NASA. They have the rocket, invented the rocket that goes up, and it's not just used once. It can come back down and land, which cuts the price of you know, it cuts the expenses exponentially, so that people can go to space like we go to China from the United States, right? And he's getting to the point where they want to do, and there's many companies that do this. Jeff Bezos actually has a company that is in that realm as well. But Elon was always in the top 400, 500 richest people in the world. He kind of was, then he got up to like the 300th richest. And, you know, he was somewhere down where Donald Trump usually is, $1, $2, $3 billion, $4 billion, whatever, until this last year. The fact that it's even possible for one man to make $150 billion in 1 year is unbelievable. But where I kind of hit this wall of like, is this even okay? And I'm not just talking about Elon, but Elon's net worth went up from like $20 billion to over $200 billion or near $200 billion in 1 year. And that year was 2020, mind you, when the rest of the world, the rest of the country was in economic turmoil with the pandemic, with the historic job losses, with you know, Congress sitting on their hands and finally barely giving $600 in aid. Elon, on the other hand, has become the richest man in the world. He's surpassed Bill Gates. He's surpassed Jeff Bezos. And good for him. That's, you know, that's great. That's capitalism at its best. But is it not also capitalism at its worst? And I know I'm going to get a lot of flack from you crazies that say I'm anti-capitalist. I want to be a socialist now. Look, I find it hard to stomach when one man is able to make $150 billion in 1 year, while an increasing number of hardworking citizens can't feed their children on a 40-hour work week salary, while the rest of the country suffered a severe, severe economic crisis, the world's richest men and women made historic gains in their net worths. Again, I am no anti-capitalist. I believe wholeheartedly in the free market. I believe the principles of capitalism are righteous. I believe capitalism is the best way to bring people out of poverty. The entrepreneurial spirit, the American dream, all of that, I believe in wholeheartedly. History has proven that communism and socialism are evil. That's clear to me. I'm not debating that. I'm not debating that. You know, this is another area where people, you know, and it's, I'm generalizing here, but a lot of people on the left, on the right, on the, wherever, tend to make this capitalism versus socialism versus whatever, or you know, having more equality in our pay, all of that. They seem to want to make it such a black and white situation, which it's not, which nothing is that we deal with in the body politic of our world, and in the politics and economics and the economy, you know, all of that. It's not as simple as just saying low taxes, better jobs, less government, less regulation, you know, anti-socialism. These are nice little, you know, campaign talking points, right? They make good slogans. They rile up people. They you know, they get the money flowing in for the campaigns and all of that. And I understand why people in politics like to simplify the issues so that they can capitalize on that, because a lot of people don't have the time, don't have the intellect, don't have the attention span to deal with real complex issues. So people like to talk in simple terms, and then we tend to see things like this in black and white or good and evil, which there it's not. It's more nuanced, it's more complex. But with all that being said, I'm a capitalist. I would never ever support a socialistic government, a communist government. I just wouldn't. And what is it that makes socialism and communism evil? Because, well, a lot of the reason that a lot of the younger people, the Bernie Sanders type people, like to call themselves socialists is because it sounds like a very great idea to spread the wealth, to let people who work you know, in the working class, in the middle class, be able to afford things and just live comfortably in America if they work hard and they achieve things, right? So what is it that makes socialism evil? Is it socialism as a thing? Does that make it evil? Or historically, has it been evil because of greed? Greed at the top, greed at the from the ruling class, greed from evil dictators is usually the underlying reason that communism and socialism have proven to be evil, have proven to fail, have proven to bankrupt societies, have proven to destroy lives, and to have situations like Venezuela where people are starving in the streets and they don't have enough bread to feed the people that live there. It's greed. It's greed is what makes that evil. But is there a point? Follow me down this path. I'm thinking out loud again. I'm not married to these ideas. Don't take me out of context and then paint me as an anti-capitalist. It sucks that I even have to qualify and keep saying that, but that's the way things work now. Is there a point when the same thing that makes communism and socialism evil can also make unchecked capitalism similarly evil or bad? Should there be a more equitable situation for the working class and the ever-shrinking middle class? Is there even a middle class left? I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I'm not an economist. I like to think that I'm very intelligent, but there's things that I just are over my head and they're over your head, right? And so here I am just thinking out loud about it. Does anybody really need $200 billion in net worth or $300 billion? When is it going to stop? If Elon Musk can make $150 billion in 1 year, in the worst year economically for the United States of America since the Great Depression, what happens when the economy is booming again? Is his net worth going to skyrocket to $500 billion? What about Bezos and all of the infrastructure and all of the things that Amazon is putting in, right? When in the drones that are going to be able to drop off packages within an hour of you clicking to buy things, is his net worth going to skyrocket? It's already has. Back in the day, I would never have thought that anybody would ever pass Bill Gates. Part of that is because Bill Gates has pledged to give away his entire net worth, and him and Warren Buffett and a lot of other ultra wealthy people, every several years they shed billions of dollars into charitable foundations because that's the right thing to do. And I would never criticize that. The one thing that I kind of... I don't know enough about it to really be angry, but one thing that I kind of rubs me the wrong way is that a lot of that money doesn't get spent here in the United States. The people that are buying Microsoft's products, the people that are buying things from Amazon, the people that are contributing to these ultra wealthy rises in their net worths, a lot of these things go to Africa, which is very needed. Don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-Africa. But there are plenty of children in the United States of America that have no idea where their next meal is going to come from. And they don't have enough supervision at home because their parents, oftentimes a single parent home, are working 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet. And they live in places like Baltimore, Maryland, or Chicago, Illinois, or or Brooklyn or the Bronx, and they can't feed their families. And so who is it that takes care of the poor? It's us, the working and middle class, that are taxed exorbitantly, I guess, I don't know, to pay to have that social safety net. What if we capped a net worth at $100 billion? And when Elon Musk's net worth jumped to $150 billion, and he gets to $100 billion, that $50 billion that he made, how about, what if that went to charitable found things in the United States of America, and not just Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, but the top 1%. Bernie Sanders gets a very bad reputation because he just doesn't know how to have a message resonate with the mainstream. He's all about the radicalism, and that's to his detriment, because some of the things that he's talking about, actually a lot of people would agree with if the messenger didn't have the baggage that he has. And also the fact that when I talked about that, you know, why is socialism evil, is because there's usually somebody at the top that is a con artist. Oftentimes it's a strongman, authoritarian dictator that is bankrupting his country, and his net worth is going sky high, and he's eating good and all that. And Bernie Sanders kind of has that air about him. He has reportedly like 3 homes, just built a new multi-million dollar home on a lake somewhere. Maybe that's not true. Maybe that's just misinformation, but it seems to me that, you know, he's always flying private or flying first class. He's seen as a radical, but that doesn't mean that some of the policies that he proposes aren't to be looked at. And, you know, people that have lots of clout, like Joe Rogan, for instance, he's listens to Bernie and says a lot of the things he has to say are great. And I think that they are too. I would never vote for Bernie, but or AOC or any of those people, because they're radical and they don't know how to temper a message or moderate a message to, you know, it just works to their detriment, really. But is there some merit there? A lot of talk this last 4 years has been about bringing jobs back to America, putting America first, making America great again. But it was never really defined what that means, right? Well, what does it mean to make America great again? Because that sentiment wasn't really broken down and explained, the enemies of that message, the left and the anti-Trump people, were able to take that and twist it into, well, what he's really talking about is make America white again, make you know, he's a racist, whatever. But what I tend to think, and I may be way off the mark, but with that message and why it resonates with so many people that are in the working class, that are making $30,000-$40,000 a year, but are getting taxed like at a crazy rate when Donald Trump himself is not paying any taxes, when Elon Musk is able to make $150 billion in 1 year, when Amazon doesn't pay taxes, when Apple doesn't pay tax, like all of this stuff. What made America great in the period that at least comes to my mind when it's talked about, make America great again, is that period right around the time post-World War II, right? When Eisenhower was the president, war hero come home, is becomes president. The all of the veterans coming home from that war, they were filled with life because they saw their friends die at 18 years old, 19 years old, just an enormous amount of loss, an enormous amount of sacrifice by this, the greatest generation. A lot of sacrifice, not just by the soldiers that went, but from the people that were left behind, the girlfriends, the wives, the families, the college careers, the athletic careers, all of these things that they put on hold to go and save the world from an existential threat. And so when they came home, the economy was back in action because we put those gears in motion to ramp up and win the war. We were out of the Great Depression. The middle class seemed to be so robust and just be thriving. There were suburban housing developments going up like wildfire. There was all of these durable goods like GM and washing machines and all made in America. They lasted. They were built to last. They were, made in America meant something. The factories that had been transformed to build airplanes and tanks and bombs and bullets and guns were back to where they could do automobiles and televisions, and just the economy was just booming. The baby boom happened. Everybody was happy. We are happy to be alive. We just survived the worst possible thing that you could ever imagine. Let's have babies. Let's start families. The GI Bill was passed so that all of these returning veterans could go and get a college degree and not be in debt for getting that college degree. That world is what I picture when Donald Trump says, we're going to make America great again. We're going to bring back our manufacturing jobs. We're going to do all these things. It really didn't materialize the way that I hoped it would. And I think the way that many, many millions of Americans that not only voted for Donald Trump, but even the ones that didn't vote for him, that were, okay, he won, let's cross our fingers. Yes, we want to make America strong and great and prosperous again. But it was never really talked about, well, what that meant, what that was. We have horrible politicians that can't even speak to us in a normal way, right? It makes me so mad because they're all about the partisanship and getting a zinger on their opponents and catching their opponents in a soundbite that they can use against them. And instead, there's so many things that we can really come together on. And that was one of them, right? Now Make America Great Again has been twisted and turned into a cult to follow an authoritarian that wants to destroy democracy. And then Bernie Sanders kind of has the same message, but he comes at it in such a radical way, and he calls himself a socialist, and that's just a non-starter. It's a non-starter. Same way with the far left and the abolish the police or defund the police. That message is a non-starter because of the way they choose to come about it. They do that because it riles up the low information people that they know are going to go take to the streets and march on that. They really believe that they want to abolish the police or defund the police completely. In reality, they just want to let the police do what the police are supposed to do and have mental health professionals take care of the people that are in crisis, the people that are overdosing, the people, instead of escalating situations, they want more training for people to be able to handle things in a way that won't harm people. And these cops that don't get enough training, and then they pretend they're soldiers and they think their lives are in danger for no good reason. And then they're trigger happy and they shoot. And it tends to be black people because I don't know why. I don't think it's all racism, but there's just a crazy misjudgment of the risk involved so that they get scared and they either, shoot people that don't need to be shot, or they have a mentality that they're a soldier, not a public servant, and they want to go kick doors in and kick people's ass, and then they end up killing people, and they look racist, right? And then they're not held accountable because back the blue, we have to back each other. It's just a mess. But we don't have anybody that's there kind of in the center that's talking about all of these things that could bring us together. Instead, they're talking about them, but they do it in a way that their opponents can then attack them. And it's just, you know, who has the one up and who's in power? We're going to be vindictive. And it's just a mess, right? But what really made America great around that time was the fact that the ultra rich paid their fair share of taxes, and there was no student debt because the returning veterans were able to go to school for free on the GI Bill. And what did that do to our economy? That created so many trained people, and it wasn't just a fake degree. Right, to get a degree. It wasn't a for-profit college that was just saying, oh yeah, come get a degree in some weird useless thing. I don't want to alienate anybody, so I'm not gonna make things up, but or make names of some of these weird useless degrees, but you know what I'm saying. They were able to become electricians, and they were able to become, you know, have a trade. They didn't have any student debt, so they were able to, but then they were also able to go and work 40 hours a week and be able to afford a suburban home with a lawn and a white picket fence. They were able to have 6 children and feed them and buy a car, buy 2 cars, buy a washing machine and a dryer, all of these things, because that middle class didn't have to get taxed at 40% and take care of the ultra poor. The ultra rich did that. And that's what Bernie Sanders is talking about. And that's what everybody's really should be talking about, but we don't. And that's why I am talking about it today. When we come back, maybe we'll break some of this down a little bit more. You're listening to Come This Far. All right, buddy. Welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. We are talking a little bit about economics, about the ultra wealthy, about the ultra poor, about the working class, about the middle class, if that's even a thing anymore. We've heard a lot about it, and also, you know, about what making America great again really would be if we had if we were able to define that. Never was really defined to us. Like I said, the opponents of that America First slogan. The problem with slogans is that they're just slogans, and they, you know, we never really break them down to like, well, what do we mean? And so I talked a little bit about when America was at its greatest. We call them the greatest generation, not just for what they did in World War II, but the way that they returned home and had that spirit to just live life to the fullest. And they had problems, right? They had issues. A lot of them were not great fathers because of the things that they suffered, the horrors of war that they suffered. They raised a generation that went to Vietnam and you know, all kinds of problems, right? It's not like, I'm not just glossing over all of that. I'm saying that they had no issues, right? But as far as, you know, making what America was about back then, in the 50s and early 60s, was that if you work hard and you have skills, and if you don't have skills, you want to better yourself. And they were able to become educated without debt because of the GI Bill. They were able to have nice homes in suburban areas because they had good paying jobs. the ultra wealthy paid their fair share of taxes so that the middle class didn't have to have the burden of taking care of the poorest Americans. And that's what we want now. That's what Bernie Sanders wants. That's what so on the far left, and that's what the far right wants. We don't know that because we're always playing politics and playing partisanship. And if we just had somebody that could explain all of this in a way that resonated with most Americans, that's how we would unite the country. And just by being good people, right? And not being worthless pieces of crap. So what does it really mean? What do people mean when they say the wealthy should pay their fair they should pay their fair share? Another thing that doesn't really get broken down a lot is the difference in income tax. So taxing the money that you earn, your salary that you make, the payroll tax and all that, and taxing wealth. Right. Wealth. Most of us don't even know what wealth is because we don't have wealth. Right. When you say, well, what's your net worth? Elon Musk is 200 billion. Well, most of us have a negative net worth, meaning that, yes, we have a home, we have cars, we have nice things, but we don't really own them. I don't own my home. I pay mortgage. I hope to one day pay off my mortgage and own my home and have assets. But most Americans, and I'm only in my early 30s, my wife is in her mid 20s, so not worried about that. We just do the best we can and not overextend ourselves. But most people have a negative net worth. So yeah, my home is worth 220,000. My cars are worth 40,000. Put together whatever. But I don't have a net worth of 240,000. Right. This is simple. The bank owns those things, and I pay monthly payments to pay them off. But most people do that, right? You might not live paycheck to paycheck. But you're not in a situation where you have millions of dollars of income every year and you bank that money and you just grow your wealth. Really, the only people that do that are people who are considered, wealthy, considered rich, considered well off, whatever you want to call it. Those people that are considered well off, and this is according to the Brookings Institute, is about 9% of the households in the U.S. that have an income greater than 200,000, and they make almost 45% of all of the pre-tax income in the country. Then there are the really rich, right? And this is the people that people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are talking about, not the well-off, not the middle management, not the small business owners, not the people that make $200,000 a year or $150,000 a year or even $300,000 a year. They're talking about really the top 0.4%. So not even the top 1%, the top 0.4% of households, about 700,000 people out of 330 million people in America have incomes above $1 million a year. And they make 13% of all the pre-tax income in our country. Since the 1980s, those at the very top have enjoyed faster growing incomes than the rest of America. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the best off Americans, the best off 1% of American households, average an annual income of $1.8 million. They saw their inflation-adjusted incomes before taxes nearly triple between 1979 and 2016. The next best off 9% saw theirs grow by 75%. while everyone else saw their pre-tax incomes rise by only 33%. The rich generally pay more of their income in incomes and taxes than the rest of us. The top fifth of households got 54% of all income and paid 69% of federal taxes. The top 1% got 16% of the income and paid 25% of the taxes. Some people argue that inequality is not as bad as some accounts suggest. They don't take into account the transfer payments, you know, the government benefits such as Social Security and food stamps and all of that that are designed to help the lower income Americans, not the upper income. But what is the difference in taxing the income, which I don't agree with? I don't think that people should have their incomes taxed by the federal government. What I more buy into is the tax on the wealth. Income is different from wealth. Income is what you earn from your labor each year, as well as interest, dividends, capital gains, and rents if you own homes that you rent out. But wealth is the value of the things you own, you know, the stocks, the bonds, the homes that you actually own, not the bank. The federal government taxes income, but generally doesn't tax wealth, except when someone makes a profit on the sale of those assets. You know, if somebody sells a stock, there's a tax. If somebody sells a piece of property, there's a tax. The Federal Reserve estimates that 1%, the top 1% holds slightly more wealth than in the entire bottom 90% of the population. And their share has been rising over time. So this is what we are talking about. What people like Elizabeth Warren are talking about. Elizabeth Warren wanted to impose a 2%, I believe, annual tax on households with a net worth of more than $50 million and a 3% tax on every dollar of net worth over $1 billion. A family worth $60 million, for instance, I'm reading here on the Brookings Institute, would owe $200,000 in wealth tax on top of their income taxes. The developers of this tax, some very liberal people from the University of California at Berkeley, estimate that 75,000 households, or about one out of 1,700, would pay that tax. So you and I would not pay that tax. And is that socialism? People who want to make this a black and white situation to make it, try to simplify it, would say, yeah, that's socialism. You know, leave the rich alone. They're the ones that are the entrepreneurs. They're the ones that create jobs. They're the ones that do all this. Advocates of a wealth tax say that it would dilute the largest fortunes in the U.S. And restrain the emergence of a plutocracy. It could encourage the wealthy to dissipate their fortunes by spending the money, giving it to charity, or giving it to their children to avoid the tax. But even so, it would still raise a lot of money. The experts say that Warren's tax would yield $2.75 trillion over 10 years. Critics say that that's a substantial overestimate. And I'm not smart enough to understand that. Probably is an overestimate. Elizabeth Warren and her people are probably overestimating that. Opponents say that a wealth tax would discourage or penalize the most successful entrepreneurs and not just the old money, right? There's difference between people who are entrepreneurs, young, who are creating all the jobs, who are doing high risk, high reward investments, and we won't want to stifle those people, right? We don't want to stifle those people. But what about all of those people that just, they pass down their net worth down and down and down, and it grows and grows and grows, and they get richer and richer and richer. You know, they don't even have to really do anything. They just put their money in you know, investments, and they just get that, their income just grows over time. So that's called old money. People who have been the ultra wealthy for generations and generations and generations. The opponents of doing this also say that the taxes would be hard to administer, because the IRS, we all know how horrible the IRS is, how incompetent the IRS is, how punitive the IRS is, how it could go on and on and on, how criminal the IRS is, whatever you want to say. They would have to not only administer taxes and tax returns, but they would also have to value things like art collections and antiques. So that would spur the rich finding loopholes to avoid the tax, the wealth on the tax. They would devalue their antiques or their or their artwork just to get by the IRS, and then they would know their real value. You know, it's all kinds of crazy things that would happen. Anyway, in 1990, a dozen countries had wealth taxes. Today, only three do. Those three seem to be doing pretty well. Norway and Switzerland being two. Spain is another one. I don't know how great Spain's doing. But opponents also note that wealth taxes often don't meet the redistributive goals that the proponents envision. So Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, you know, are they really telling us the truth? I know my friends on the right would say absolutely not. They're not telling us the truth. They're evil. They don't care about us. And, you know, who really knows? Some people want to increase what's known as the estate tax, or I think that's called the death tax. When somebody's estate, when they die, the estate tax is levied on the assets of the very best off, the richest Americans. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 increased the level at which the federal estate tax kicks in. At a rate of 40%, that applies only to estates over 11.2 million. So if you have a net worth of over 11.2 million and you die, then it's taxed at 40% before that estate is able to be settled. So only 2 of every 1,000 people are wealthy enough to even trigger the tax when they die. So, you know, does that really bring in a lot of revenue? I don't know. It says here that the estate taxes brought the government about $19 billion in 2019. I guess $19 billion would have paid for one aircraft carrier, maybe. So another proposal that is talked about would be to lower the threshold to estates to where 3.5 million. So anyone who has a net worth of 3.5 million, not 11.2 million, I guess that's where it used to be, would impose taxes depending on the size of the estate. There'd be like a tiered situation, and that would raise more than $300 billion over 10 years. But advocates of an estate tax hold that it is a good way to avoid dynastic wealth in the U.S. and make the U.S. a fair place where merit matters more than the net worth of one's parents. So there'd be a lot less people that were trust fund babies or people that are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. You know, their net worths are guaranteed from the time they're born. They go to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and they do all these things. They pretend like they're so great and intelligent, but really they haven't accomplished anything. They haven't struggled. Those are the people that tend to be in power in Washington. And then, you know, they really couldn't care less. Not that they couldn't care less, but that they don't even understand what it means to be a working class American or even a middle class American. They don't understand that struggle. They have different issues. I'm not saying they live perfect lives. A lot of them are very screwed up, just like the rest of us. But they don't have the problem of worrying about where their next meal is going to come from. They don't have to worry about, paying their bills. So these are all things that are talked about. And in my opinion, they're not talked about in a way that most people can understand them. Even here, I feel like a lot of you are going to drown out because I'm just reading numbers and even I'm not very interested in it. So I'm going to kind of avoid that going forward here. Another thing that people want to talk about is lifting the payroll tax, the payroll tax cap. So Social Security is financed by a 12.4% tax on wages, and that's split evenly. Everybody that works, they pay 12.4% of that to the Social Security. But in 2034, and that's only 13 years from now, it's supposed to be run dry. And so people like me, I'm 34, when I get to be 65 or 70, is there even going to be a Social Security fund there? The way it's going now, no, there won't be. In the 1930s, when Social Security began, about 92% of earnings from jobs covered by the program were taxed. But as wages have grown, the cap hasn't kept up. So about 83% of earnings are hit by or triggered the Social Security payroll tax. So one option would be to raise the ceiling to $285,000. Right now, the payroll tax applies to wages up to $132,000. Anything over $132,000 doesn't go into the Social Security, and that's where people are paid, disabilities and retirements for the lower income Americans. So one option would be to raise that ceiling to $285,000. So it'd still be 12.4%. It would just be 12.4% of $285,000 and not just $132,000. So that would be a way to make those people. But again, that's income. That's you work hard for that money. You get a salary, you labor. I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan of taxing income. I know it's harder to tax wealth and it's harder and there's more ways that the ultra wealthy can skirt that and can get behind, and would that stifle entrepreneurial spirit if you're taxing their wealth and not just what they make every year? I don't see how that would be, because you're still going to be an entrepreneur. You're still going to want to raise, you're still going to want to make money. You're still going to want to increase your net worth. But just because the government, I don't buy into the fact that, I'm not going to make up to this amount because I don't want the government to take it. I just don't see people doing that. It's not like they're going to be like, all right, I can't make more than this year, or they're going to tax me. They've always been able to give to charity and find loopholes, and so they're not taxed. And those are good things. Are good. Those things help charitable foundations and everything else. But we just need to have a more robust discussion about this stuff instead of just having sound bites and having AOC, pipe off, and then having someone on the far right call her a radical socialist, and then Bernie Sanders comes in, and it's like we're just playing into the hyper-partisanship. We're just playing into those sound bites and those slogans that don't mean anything. We're not digging deeper. If we could just dig deeper and we could find out what really it would be to make America great again, and what that even means, and what does it mean to tax the top 1% or the top 0.4%? Are they talking about taxing their income? Or are they talking about taxing their net worth, the money that they're just gonna pass down to the dynasty, to their kids and grandkids? And does anybody need a net worth of over $200 billion? Could we cap the net worth at $100 billion? And then when ultra, these big tech billionaires make $100 billion in 1 year, it's capped, I guess. I don't know. I'm thinking out loud. I'm not married to any of these things. But there has to be a way that we all can agree. But if we could just be honest and talk about it, and not try to oversimplify it, because it's very complex, but also have leaders that can talk about it in a way that they don't feel like they're just some Ivy League lawyer talking to us about, you know, all these figures and all these things. That we need normal people that have the capacity to grasp this and understand it, with the experts telling us what we need, you know, what we need, with no ulterior motives, with no animosity, just Americans saying, look, we all want to go back to when we had better jobs, to where we didn't have a lot of debt, where we didn't have, where college, it didn't cost $300,000 to get a worthwhile college degree. I realized that the way to get around that is go to serve in the military, and you were able to go to school with the GI Bill like I did, like my dad did, like my brother did. I don't have student loans, and I'll have a college degree. My brother is in a master's program now, paid for by the GI Bill. My father has a college degree paid for by the GI Bill. In World War II, basically virtually every male that went to fight came home and used the GI Bill, and they were able to make the economy go, and they were able to pay for things and buy things and feed their families and feel like they could attain some wealth, not just have a negative net worth. And they were able to retire comfortably and take care of their family. They're not ultra wealthy by no means. They live in modest homes, but they felt like they put in a hard day's work over a week, 40 hours or 50 hours a week, and were able to feed their families. And people increasingly are not able to do that. But yet Elon Musk has a net worth now of $200 billion, when earlier in the year he was only around $30 billion or $40 billion. There has to be a middle ground, and we have to be able to talk about it without being labeled a socialist or an evil communist or whatever. Enough. Joe Biden is not a socialist. Joe Biden is not a communist. It's just not so. Bernie Sanders is a self-described socialist. We should be very mindful of that. He doesn't do himself any favors by calling himself that, because some of the policies that he has, actually, I think, if talked about, could be managed and could be worked. But the middle class, the working class, does not need to be burdened any further. The very poor need to be taken care of by the ultra rich. And we need to find a way to do that, plain and simple. I hope this episode didn't go, you know, bore you. I hope it got some things in your mind to think about, namely just coming together so that we could tackle all of this stuff in a way that is not just going to further divide us. We just have to get past these campaign slogans and finding a dirt on our opponents if I decide to run for Congress ever again, somebody will use this video and say, he's a socialist, he wants to be a socialist. You know, That's such crap. And us as voters, we shouldn't put up with it. Anybody who's playing that game, anybody, you don't care, you know, if they say they're not a politician, if they're playing that game, then they're a freaking politician and they don't need to have our vote or our hard-earned money to fund their campaigns. Don't let them send you emails and texts saying, oh, the evil socialists are striking again. Pay me $2 right now and it'll be matched 10 million times. And it's like, okay, just stop. Just shut up and let's vote for people that, regardless of how much money they can raise on their campaign, let's hear their message. Let's hear their experiences. Let's see if they have what it takes to represent us in a way that will benefit us. And let's stop us here in the working middle class. Let's stop advocating against ourselves because of some made up myth that if the rich are taxed, their wealth is taxed in a way that can take care of some of the more social problems, that means that we live in a socialist country. Now, that's garbage as well. Don't listen to those voices on the fringe that are just making things up. Listen to people who have our best interests at heart. You can understand. I think people are able to feel authenticity and when someone's being genuine, and we have to have that sense, those sensors in our mind, be more in tune with those, because we can, if we really tried and worked at it, we could find the people who are just lying to us. You can just tell, right? You can tell when somebody's authentic. So if we get that whiff of, oh, that guy's not really authentic. I like him. He's saying all the right things. Your impression about somebody is usually correct. If you get a whiff of inauthentic behaviors, then they probably are a snake and they're probably lying to you. And they're probably just trying to get your campaign money so that they can grasp power. Catch you on the next week. You're listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor.